Good morning.
Hey, I have to scoot out a little bit. And I don't want to upset it because it's set for Marianne. Good to see you this morning as we resume the adult forum. It's been a busy summer, a sad summer for many, a dryest for others. So it's good to be back with this particular group again. As you know, from time to time, we have an adult forum session, which we call, what is it, Faith and Life. And we ask people to share in any way they want to shape their presentation however they wish. And Pastor Marietta Skinner has agreed to lead us off this season with her take on faith and life. I read the title of her presentation, the title that she gave it, and I thought it's kind of like life or spiritual calisthenics, because she called it taking leaps and jumps, not knowing the landing place. So, thank you for that.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is another jump. So I'm gonna get right in, because I did script it, and I will just start going and then tell you that the earliest memory that I have is of a one-room church. There was a high pulpit, and in the wintertime, the big pot-bellied stove took up half of the church, and I can still hear the ringing and tolling bell over the countryside. The women sat on the left side, the men sat on the right, and at Christmas time there would be a curtain strung across the front so that we could say our pieces. It had a steeple with an anchor on the top. The name of the church, Freedom's Evangelical and Reformed Church, which has become the United Church of Christ. That's one memory. Second memory is of a tiny 10-month-old baby with black tubes in his nose from his tonsils and adenoids being removed. And then seeing that little boy in a casket by the living room window, and the smell of the flowers, the quiet voices and the weeping, and again the tolling of the church bell as the funeral procession approached. Otherwise, my early recollections are a blur. My mind is blank except for fragments. But there's one that is clear, and that is shaking the barnyard gate, sobbing and pleading with God for someone to come adopt and love me. I was a skinny, lonely, and fearful, shy, cross-eyed kid with broken off front teeth, later abused by an uncle who, by the way, was the only one who could spontaneously pray at church. So I've divided what I want to say to you into three parts. And phase one is pertaining to God. And I call it getting growed. And it happened from 1936 to 1954. I was born in the north bedroom of a farmhouse at 5 p.m. Saturday, March the 14th, 1936, in Wabash County, Illinois. I was the oldest of four children, born to Bernard Skinner and Marie Lipper Skinner. My father had been making tire treads for Firestone in Akron, Ohio, until his job loss in the Depression. He returned to his English settlement home in Albion and delivered milk from his mother's house. And my mother grew up in the German farming community on the other side of Bumbalt Creek. That was the dividing line. English lived on one side, the Germans lived on the other. As a tenant farmer starting out in the land-owning German community, my father, the townie, began with a team of horses and an old steel-wheel case tractor. Till I was 18, we had no electricity, running water, an outhouse, cold heat in the wintertime, slept under feather beds, and in the summer would sleep outside because of the humidity and the heat. Daily chores were feeding livestock, gathering eggs, milking cows, separating the milk, swapping the hogs. And except the staples like flour, sugar, and spices, it was a huge garden with canning and then the storage of root vegetables in the cellar, with the butchering of beef, pork, and chicken that provided our year-round food. The crops in the fields, the wheat, corn, clover, and alfalfa were mostly to sustain the animals. I could read early, and I escaped the isolation from my parents, who unintentionally abandoned me with the illness and death of their baby boy, because I could read and then I could pretend to be the lives that I read. Bridget's schoolwork was meticulously done and I was an A student, but I never spoke in class. My mind would go blank into a darkness with no ability to find words when asked to respond to questions or to be in a direct conversation. I carried a book with me and I hid in the corner at gatherings. However, 4-H gave me many rewards, even to making a demonstration of making muffins at the Illinois State Fair at the age of 12. My friend did the talking. I did the measuring and the mixing. My friends were Jane, the Baptist, and there were Wednesday evening prayer meetings and spontaneous praying. Mary Helen was the Methodist with revivals, and I remember the pounding red-faced preachers and the crawling to the earth, to the altar sinners. Betty was the Pentecostal with the laying on of hands and healings, and I actually saw a woman who had not walked for years get up and walk. Jane, the Roman Catholic, had Jane hanging Jesus on the cross, the candles and the incense, and the nuns all in black except for the white that framed their faces. And all of them knew the right way. However, my mother took the baptism seriously. On Sunday morning, all the outside chores, all the inside chores were done. We were at Sunday school at 9:30 sharp, when Hypocus Raver, a very tall farmer, took the pocket watch out of his pocket and rang the church bell. And you know, I lived the Jesus stories, because I could see the dropping of the dead hard seeds from the corn planter and the weed drill. I could see them going into the earth, being covered up. And then when the rains came and the sun, you'd see all these tiny sprigs of green lining the fields. Death to resurrection. We had shocks of wheat, just like in the Bible. But we didn't have a threshing machine that would come and make a straw stack that was higher than the barn. And then I could be like Moses on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments, or with Jesus in the Transfiguration. And believe me, I played them out. The broadcasting of seeds, when you hear the story of how the farmer walked the field and there was the rocky soil and the not so good, I saw that because my father had a broadcaster who'd walk up and down the field. You'd see the birds coming in to eat the seeds. You'd see it happening. There was the shucking of corn, ear by ear, but the baby lambs and the senseless sheep. And you know what? It's not so bad that Jesus was born in a stable, because with the animals, it is so warm, so cozy, so peaceful, and by the lantern light, it is really almost holy. However, I was to love and obey what to me at that time was frightening God. I think God was something like the boogeyman. In the wind, in the lightning storms of the Midwest. And then I would look at the white Jesus on the Sunday school leaflets, shown with a peaceful space. And I could never be good enough or clean enough. I did pray every night. Now I lay me down to sleep. My confirmation verse was, "For God so loved the world." And that is how I entered the outside world at the age of 18 when I left home. I had been a cherished one for the first 3 years of my life, who had been put aside for a little baby who struggled with two bouts of pneumonia, pneumococcus meningitis, followed by another meningitis of which he gaspingly died. After that, a baby of grace, my sister Kathleen, was born and bundled up and carried around the farm to heal my wounded father's heart. Then the son, William Ben, came along. In all this, I had the sense of living alone among my family, not allowed to cry, in a make-believe world of books and pretend that took away the pain. I would play with dolls. I would construct houses in the empty corn cribs with animals as my comforting friends. And the church, which I told you was my first vivid memory, was my haven of security. There were no leaps and jumps at that time. I just wanted to be able to take the next step. I wanted to become a teacher, live on a farm with animals, plants, and have lots of children. That was phase one, God. Phase two has to do with Jesus. I call it getting educated. It happened from 1954 to 1980. And I notice when speakers are usually introduced, you get their academic credentials. So I'm going to give you mine. And then I'll go into the leaping and the jumping. I have a teaching degree from Eastern Illinois University. I have a master's degree in supervision and curriculum from the University of Iowa. I have coursework from New York University's Washington University, University of Illinois, and University of Michigan. I was a third grade teacher in Lawrenceville, Illinois, Modesto, California, and on a United States Strategic Air Command base in Zaragoza, Spain. I was a first grade demonstration teacher at the University of Iowa in problem solving. I was a principal of child psychiatry school at the University of Iowa, assistant professor in education, State University, New York, Oneonta, and had a sabbatical in New Zealand, Australia, and Papua New Guinea. Okay, those are credentials. Now, what goes on when all this happened? With children, I could speak. I had a voice. And so in the farm community where I first taught, and then the Hispanic community in California, the Air Force dependents overseas, the laboratory school, and the classrooms of the emotionally impaired, I did have a voice. So my first 9 months in the early years of teaching were in the classroom, and then summer times were for cultural interactions working alongside the others. Let me tell you about this. After 3 years of teaching in the farming area, Illinois, and seeing no possibility of living on the farm because I read too many books, I took a road map of California and I wrote superintendent of schools and put down the name of the city and mailed them, all in the San Francisco area. All my possessions went with me across the country to Modesto, California, where schools were not opened for not snow days, but for fog days. The fog would be so thick that school couldn't be held. I left a year later to teach for the United States Air Force in Spain, and this was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had the trunk packed for escape to a monastery in the mountains. And later that year, meeting the Spanish on the streets who stopped us with tears in their eyes, grieving the death of our U.S. President Kennedy. I went to every corner of Spain, bagpipes, wooden shoes, Roman, Greek, Moorish ruins, the flamenco and hoda dancing, sangria and gazpacho. In other places in Europe, I sat with forgiven Lutheran pastors who had been Nazis. I returned to the U.S. to interact with a very strange and untouchable black boy in child psychiatry. And then I trusted, like Abraham and Sarah, to go to foreign countries alone in the South Pacific because I believed God would be beside me. Okay, that's kind of what was going on in my teaching. Now I'm telling you about what I call leaps and jumps. Number one, caravanning in the late 1940s through the 1950s in the Evangelical and Reformed Church was a summer volunteer program for youth. Teams were trained to go to church youth groups for motivation, are planted in needy places, and they were always to have a person of color. From the white Germanic farmlands, I was at Kenwood Ellis Community Church in South Chicago, a huge church that had been deserted by white flight, and it had been left for the newly arriving immigrants from the South, and interesting enough, the Japanese who had been in internment camps. When they were released, they would come into cities where there was low-income housing to get started again. And that summer, the living was in the farmer maid's quarters on the third floor of an armor meatpacking family home. Two summers later, I was invited to come back because I needed help with their program and I had no place to live. Mr. Morrow, African American, had space in the former maid's quarters of his home. Mrs. Morrow was opposed to my coming. What will your parents say with you living with niggers? I entered the back door. I climbed the narrow stairs to my lodging all summer, or all that time. And before my leaving, before one Sunday, she said, "Do you like grits?" And we had a family breakfast together. In later years, when she met my mother, her comment was, "Mrs. Skinner, I hope you don't mind, but I'm Marietta's black mama." At that time, when my dad came to pick me up, I got the biggest surprise. He invited Mr. Morrow to bring his friends and hunt in the countryside where no black person was allowed to stay overnight in the county. But he always asked the landowners permission when they came, and he was called a nigger lover by a member of the Freedom's congregation. We had lunchtime fellowship with each man sitting at the table praying his favorite Bible verse. My dad butchered beef for them, and they would drive their cars one way just for a day of hunting, and they drove for a final time for my dad's funeral, and I heard, "Your father was not a white man to us. He was our friend." The thread of black people in my life, that leap, still moved on. There was this little black child in child psychiatry school that no one could touch. For about 5 minutes he would come to be with me. He would babble, stick his fingers in his ears, lay on the floor, and kick. Until in the medical staffing I heard that he could read, so I was ready. The next time I held up a sentence strip, just held it up, "David, get up." He looked at it, he got up. I got the next sentence strip, "David, sit down." He sat down. And that became our first form of communication. And it increased from 5 minutes to an hour. And months later, he left to be part of a vocational guiding place. Later on, when I was training student teachers that wanted inner city schools experience, I required them to attend worship at the African American St. Paul Baptist Church in Utica, New York, and to be involved in community activities. Okay. That was a leap, to leave the farm and go into a city with people that I had no contact with ever before. Leap two, then the summer times became for volunteering. I was part of a World Council of Churches International Group building a church camp on Maui in Hawaii. I led a group to build a church in Puerto Rico, and I cooked for them on a two-burner gas plate with poles bringing water down the hillside. It was renovating a Cadbury candy estate outside Birmingham, England, for the poor children of the city. And in La Castaneda High in the Italian Alps among the Waldensians, and I don't know if you know that there were early reformers before Martin Luther. The Waldensians in Italy in the 11th and 12th centuries spoke out against the Catholic Church, saying that the Bible was the word and this is what they preached. And they remain to this day. There, a retreat center was begun with wheelbarrows, shovels, and ropes. The foundation for a German woman who had lived through the war and her French husband, they had this dream to have a prayer center for people of the West to come together with the communist East and pray. So that was a leap. All of these work campings during the summer that put me with different cultures, the people who believed in Jesus. Leap three, I taught the problem-solving method as a demonstration teacher at the University of Iowa Elementary Laboratory School. The children raised the questions. We wrote stories and plays, planted, tended, harvested the garden, made vegetable soup. And I was under constant observation by student teachers and returning classroom teachers. A woman came to request that I start a school over in the medical complex at Child Psychiatry for the children who were only being tutored. These were children that could not be kept in the home, the school, or the community, and so they were hospitalized to see what help could be given to them. These bewildering 5 to 16-year-olds were the most challenging and lovable ones of my life. And this included the black boy that I described to you. That was when I had that contact. Okay, I don't call this a leap. I call this a jump. I wandered into a Lutheran church. And that's true. I wandered in. In New Hartford, New York. And I found the liturgy a new form of worship for me, and I was really puzzled. But the preaching was good. The next week, when I returned, someone greeted me, and this is the key. Someone greeted me with, "Hello, Marietta, I'm glad to see you." I never left that church. I followed the announcement that 10 people would be trained for the Bethel Bible Series, and I memorized through the 2 years of instruction and became the lead-off teacher for the people. And that changed my life. Blessed to be a blessing became my motto, and you know what? We know that Abraham and Sarah was blessed, but do you know that Hagar, the banished concubine of Abraham, was blessed? And do you know that her son Ishmael was blessed? And they are seen today as the people who began the Arab world. Just think about that. There wasn't anything I wouldn't do at Zion Lutheran Church. I cooked paella for the women. I did piano duets with the organist. I was the lone woman on the council. And when the snow kept me from getting my car in the driveway, I would ski to church. Okay, leap number five. In the 1970s, in education, values clarification was the focus. And there were workshops in the Adirondack Humanistic Education Center, where the third part of Jesus' commandment became a reality for me. I've already told you that in the first phase of my life, loving God was the first part, the first commandment. And then I've been describing about loving neighbor. But there's a third part. It's loving yourself. Loving yourself, which I had never heard very much about. And that was so exciting and so important. I remember celebrating my value by running as fast as I could and jumping in trust into uplifted hands and just jumping and saying over and over, "I'm to love myself, I'm to love myself, I'm to love myself." Wow. a wonderful experience. Leaf number six, I met a man there. I watched him all week. I watched how he moved, talked, and interacted, and I was fascinated. The Catholics invited participants for the Friday morning mass. He was the officiating priest. I was embarrassed. Yet we became friends, and I received touches of the Roman Catholic world. In his southern congregation, we sang the Old Rugged Cross. In the congregation in Connecticut, I learned how his congregation held the city responsible for housing the displaced poor before the property could be condemned and redeveloped. When he was elected to one of the leadership positions of his La Salette order, I was invited to the Vatican to be with the priests from around the world, and I traveled with them to their shrine high in the French Alps, where once shepherd children had an apparition of Mary. Mary's message was, pay attention to my son, he has a lot to tell you. Time was spent in songs and prayers at Taizé. And I have on the La Salette cross, which I find very interesting, Jesus is on the Catholic cross. But on one of the cross beams is a hammer, meaning we are the ones that hammer the nails into Jesus. But on the other side is a pair of pliers. We are also the ones that pull out the nails. This priest introduced me to the spirituality of the Ignatius of Loyola, who was the founder of the Jesuits. Retreats became part of my faith support. Going for a week of silence, all I had would be the scripture and daily sharing with the director to walk into the word and bring it into my life. Okay, jump seven. The Lutheran Church in Germany held a seminar for Americans to hear the stories of German people as to how they lived through the war. At that time, three strands of barbed wire divided Germany's countryside. Three converted pastors, I mentioned them before, who had been Nazis, shared their involvement. One, at the age of 15, was fighting in the last days of the war on the streets of Munich. Two, had been an SS soldier taken as a prisoner of war to a camp in Mississippi. He had been involved in the July plot on Hitler's life, and he never knew how he was not discovered and executed. And then the third pastor had flew for the Luftwaffe. I walked through Dachau with a young German who kept murmuring, I didn't know. You know, I tell you these stories, but there's also things that happen when you get to these places that sometimes you wonder how you got there. To get to this seminar, I went through Switzerland to Munich. And when I got on the last train in Zurich to cross the border, I had a lot of luggage because I was going to be in the summertime in Bavaria and then go into the high mountains, which was cool. So I was on the back car of the train, and the conductor motioned that I belonged in the front. Well, I couldn't take everything at once, so I took my purse with my passport, all my money, and whatever else I could carry, took it forward, and there was an empty seat, and I nodded to the passengers and put it on the street like they would take care of it. I went back to get the two big suitcases, and when I opened the door of the train, the front part of the train was going down the track. Okay, things happened. On that same trip, when I left Munich to go to the Alps, I got on a crowded train. They have compartments where there are six people that sit in a narrow aisle. Well, I couldn't get into one of the compartments, so I sat in the jump seat. And then as time went on, four other people in the six passenger cubicle left, and there were two men on either side. And so they motioned for me to come in and put all my things on the seats like it was occupied. This was an overnight train. So that night, I slept between these two strange men. I was so afraid that my feet would smell or I would snore or whatever. Whatever. But on that same trip, to get up to this high place in the mountains, I took a train out of Milan, and it went to this little village and then just stopped at the foot of the mountain, the track stopped. And I had no possible way to get up to where I needed to be. This man came over, he had a little bitty car, and through all of our motions, I knew he was asking if he could take me up. But here was a strange man, I was in a strange place, and I didn't seem to be as protected as in the other places. However, he said, when he noticed my doubt, he said, come meet my mama and my papa. So when I met his mama and his papa, I decided it was all right. So I loaded the luggage in the little car and we wound up the mountainside. I just tell you this because there are all these kinds of stories that go on with the helpfulness of people, which I think God provides when you move about, such as I did. Take a breath. Leap 8. There was a sabbatical. And on the sabbatical, I could visit schools in New Zealand. The North Island, with my backpack, I would take a bus, go to the next town, go up to the school, introduce myself, and say, I'd like to spend the day here watching your teachers and your children. And I was always welcome. And again, all kinds of interactions happened on the sidelines. When I stayed at a bed and breakfast one night, Grace, who was the owner, said, come and have a glass of wine with me. And somehow we got into prayer. And Grace says, you know, I'm an Anglican and the priest uses such beautiful words when he prays, and I would like to pray like that to God. And I said, well, Grace, God takes your words just however you are. And she said, he does? And I said, yes. So we spent the rest of the evening practicing prayer. Grace and I, we would pray together, and she became accustomed to that she could use her own words. And hopefully she went on to pray in her congregation. At another place, when I got to the inn too late, the innkeeper's wife said, I'll fix you a bite to eat. And then she sat down with me. And she takes my hand and she says, you know, this story I have never told and it's heavy on my heart, although it's been a blessing. She said, when the Americans came, when the Japanese were here, because there was heavy fighting that part of New Zealand, it was to the far north. She said, I fell in love with this American soldier. He left, said he'd come back to get me. I never saw him again, but I was pregnant. And she said, the innkeeper that you have met, he brought out my daughter as his own. And so she needed to tell her story. And on the bus the next day, because after I had that meal, I went and sat in the bar and I met the Maori people and the Scotch people and the different people that had immigrated there. On the bus, one of the women stepped out on the route, stopped the bus, and she had a picnic basket for me so that I would have good food during the day. But a story I really liked was that in Rotorua, again, an evening meal and joining a mother and daughter who were traveling to meet their husbands. We had conversation, sharing our stories. And the next morning, the daughter hands me their house keys in Wellington, which is at the bottom of the North Island to cross to the south. She hands me the house keys and she said, you just go and you can stay as long as you like. Let the neighbors know who you are. And when you leave, put the keys on the table, shut the door. So, incidentally, with all of these leaping and jumping, I found that there were people along the way, I call them Jesus people, to help me along. after New Zealand, oh, another thing in New Zealand, I got to walk the Milford Trek, which is a special walk where you walk in the tropical lower level, and then you climb the back up into the spine or backbone of a mountain, and then you cross over to see the fjords of New Zealand. And I walked with the Kiwis, I walked with New Zealanders, and met people who had these huge sheep farms. I went on to Australia and was part of an Aussie excursion into the outback, going up to Darwin, down the center to Alice Springs and Ayers Rock, and on to Adelaide before going back to Sydney. The roads were still red clay, and one day when it rained, the bus slipped off, and of course we all got off the bus and pushed. And at night, the Aborigines with their didgeridoos would play and dance by the firelight. Lutheran, at this same sabbatical, Lutheran Brotherhood Exchange sponsored me to go to Lay Teachers College in Papua New Guinea, a Lutheran missionary school. As a recently independent country, education was a key. So I got sent to schools in the jungle, along the seaside, up the mountain, where the chief asked if I knew Margaret Mead, who had brought medicines to them. Schools for the children consisted of blackboard and chalk, backless benches inside a thatched hut. One weekend, I was a chaperone, the only white skin, for college students from Lay to go from Valley, that was called Valley Teachers College, to go to Yambo Village to play basketball and soccer. We left at midnight in an African Queen kind of boat, and we putted along the coast under the southern stars. Otherwise, it would have been a 12-hour hike through the jungle. Being a Christian village, we were met by being thrown into the sea for the celebration of our baptism. And then, dripping wet, we all feasted in the early hours of the morning. For Sunday morning worship, only the men could go into the open-air thatch-roof sanctuary. But I was considered a dignitary, and I was invited to join the men. But I elected to sit outside with the women and the children. When it was time to go, all the villagers, from the little one to the tallest, lined up to give us a cheerio as the outriggers rowed us out to the boat. And on the way back, I had my first and only drug experience of my entire life. It was betel nut. Remember Bloody Mary in South Pacific? Okay, let me tell you about betel nut, because most of the students would chew it because they would have red teeth. You take the nut, you chew some greens and some lime, and you chew this all up in your mouth. And then this is to get the full effect of the drug. I didn't realize that then you were to spit that out. I swallowed it. And I was so high. It was so high that I think they were dolphins jumping out there, and I was ready to jump with them, and I had the students hold my hands and my feet to keep me secure. Okay, I tell you these leaps and jumpings, and I named it that, and as my Jesus part of my life, because what happened is that white, clean Jesus on my Sunday school leaflets became many shades. He had callous feet, scraggly hair, and unkempt clothes. The Hawaiian people like their women to be huge. The huger you are in Hawaii as a woman, oh. So in Lahaina, there's a picture of Madonna Mary. Oh, is she ever huge? Holding baby Jesus. And then on a church, a Maori church in New Zealand, etched on the church window was a feather-caped Polynesian King Jesus. King Jesus was all on one side of the church. In Chicago and Papua New Guinea, Jesus had kinky black hair, and then with the Japanese, slanty eyes. So Jesus was reaching out from the cross with wide open arms to those black immigrants that had come from the south, from the freed Japanese, from the internment camps, for the racially mixed Hawaiians, the subsistent Puerto Ricans, the former Nazis in Germany, those who were communist controlled. So my Jesus belonged to so many colors and cultures. And the best discovery for me was that Jesus personally belonged to women. When you know the stories of Jesus and women, the bleeding one, the bent over woman, the one at the well, the Syrophoenician, the one to be stoned, and then Mary Magdalene, who announced it all, he is risen. Jesus was for all. So taking those leaps with all the different peoples and cultures, this made Jesus, and then God became so much bigger and so much wider. Okay, take a breath. I have one more phase. Just kind of wiggle your arms a little bit. Okay, phase three is the spirit. It's getting surprised from 1980 to 2016. And actually, it's not leaping and jumping. It's bounding and pole vaulting. Because my life completely turned around. What happened was I got a Master's of Divinity at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. I became a parish pastor at Ascension Lutheran Church, Rome, New York. Beautiful Savior Lutheran Church, Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. The Nokomis Philharmonic Parish in Illinois. And later an interim pastor at New Hope Lutheran Church, El Paso, Texas. And then at Calvary Lutheran Church, Belleville, Illinois. And this is the bounding and the pole vaulting, because when I returned from the sabbatical, I wrote for a leave of absence from the State University of New York to study at the University of Minnesota for my PhD. The new pastor at Zion Lutheran Church, where I became Lutheran, called me a living legend, and after a few months looked me straight in the eye to say, "I believe you're a woman called to be pastor." I was rude. I laughed in his face. Yet I was intrigued. I was insecure. I had tenure. I was a bona fide educator with credibility, and I was going on to higher studies. So I set out to prove him wrong. The checking process by Upstate New York Synod was in three phases. First, you met on a one-to-one with somebody who questioned you and made the decision whether you had promised to go on to seminary. Step two was a luncheon with lay people who again would question and talk with you about what they saw you as a prospective pastor. And step three was a meeting with the selection committee meeting. A committee set up, and were they ever harsh in their screening on whether you would be seen fit to go to seminary? At all of them, there wasn't one red flag to spot me. Not one. And I was told to go. I didn't have to take the psychologicals or any more scrutiny. In other words, I was just told, get out and go. So this is where I pole vaulted. I resigned from the university, loaded up a U-Haul, and drove to Chicago at the age of 44 into an assembly line of meeting of the new students meeting the faculty, and it went something like this as the students went down the line. "Oh, I knew your father. He was pastor at so-and-so Lutheran Church. Oh, you're from a long line of Lutheran pastors. It goes way back to your great grandfather. I know that name. Oh, you were a student at Mount Hall. Want to be be said to me. I had no Lutheran credentials, my background. I was a state university graduate, and I was an older woman with all these young students. And the line got really quiet. And they just kind of dribbled me down the line. When I would meet with my advisor, he wouldn't keep eye contact with me. He'd always be looking around the room like I wasn't even in the room. It was like I was a nobody. In a rich theological community, including the University of Chicago and numerous seminaries, I was bound to take only Lutheran classes, and I was given no lifetime experience credit. By Christmas, I was on my knees crying. I almost wanted to say, what the hell am I doing here? I had to lift out, what the hell. In January, I walked out when a phone call came from my mother saying she was ill. I went home to be beside her because she had a diagnosis of leukemia. Surprisingly enough, the professor sped the assignments and I saved the second term. And when my brother came to be with mother, I did my clinical pastoral experience at Deaconess Hospital in Evansville, Indiana. A parathyroid was exploding calcium into my system, and it sent me to Mayo Clinic for surgery. Cancer cells were seen under a microscope on the thyroid, so that was removed too. I returned to LSTC a basket case for year number two. Panic and fear would strike me that cancer cells were spreading throughout my body. And one day while washing dishes, the darkness came. And the only way I could stop it was the very simple of the mantra of the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. I sat there and I just focused on that. And then the voice was very clear. My daughter, you are healed to become a pastor. When it came time for the internship assignments, I was delighted that an interviewing pastor and I instantly hit it off. So I was anticipating being in his parish. However, I was sent to Richardson, Texas to be a supervisor that was known for chewing up interns. Before going there, I asked for a 10-month assignment and left for a month in Greece and was in the Orthodox world with a free-spirited friend who talked the local fishermen to take us in a boat from island to island. There had been other outside experiences along with the studies. The steel mills of Gary, Indiana, the wheat fields of Nebraska, the copper mines of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and then Holy Week, one year was spent in communist Romania with the Easter Vigil being held in a crowded Orthodox church within sight of the Soviet border. We visited Baptists in Czechoslovakia, where everyone bicycled to church. Christians could not hold paying jobs and therefore could not afford cars. And in Hungary, a bishop told us his stories of how it was to remain during the Russian purge of his country. Two early happenings in that Texas internship established a positive relationship between my supervisor and myself. He wanted nothing, absolutely nothing to do with introducing the new LBW to the congregation. At that time, it was the green one. He didn't want anything to do with it, so he put me in charge. The second thing that happened was that for Thanksgiving, I was scheduled to preach. And just before, I heard that black family in Chicago, the Morals, the Hunters, were in a fire and had died. I went to my supervisor and said, I must go. They are my family. He says to me, is your sermon prepared? I said, yes. He said, I will preach it. He was a man who wrote sermons for a journal and prided himself in preaching, and he became my cheerleader for the pulpit until he died. In returning back to LSTC, I was questioned how my internship could be so praiseworthy. But Simonex had disbanded at this time, and a lot of the professors had come to LSTC. So for the last year, I had all Simonex professors. Krentz, Hindle, Barmaster, Bertram. I did not have adequate funds for my final year, even though when I had been in seminary the first 2 years, I worked for $5 an hour doing housework. But here's what happened. A will came from the estate of Minnie Isinger from the Zion congregation, and she had frequently sent me $10 to buy a book. The will was divided into three parts, one for the church, one for Lutheran homes, and the third part had 10 sections with two or three names in each one. And my name was in the 10th with three other names, and I thought, oh, Minnie's going to give me another $10. Her estate was large enough that it paid to the last penny my last year at seminary, and I left without debt. My first call came before I left seminary, and after I walked in my ordination procession, which there was a Jewish friend walking beside me carrying the stole she created about our common ground of creation. And as I walked in the procession, I looked around the church at my family. There was the Oneonta professors, the tramp and trail hikers, because once in the Tetons, we climbed the 11,000 foot Wind River Peak. There was the black faces from St. Paul's Baptist Church. There were Zion supporters and members from my new congregation. And none of my blood relatives were there. My mother had died. My sister didn't approve. My Jehovah Witness brother saw the church and clerics as evil. My bishop called the ordination wild. And one of the things that happened was, during the hymn of praise, instead of the usual hymn of praise, there was a voice that, a single voice from the back of the church, "We're marching to Zion." And then other voices joined, and the black choir, as only black people can do, came sashaying down the aisle, singing. And I watched the Lutherans, who were so proper, wanting to look around and see what was happening. And what was so exciting was by the time the choir took their many minutes to get down the aisle, the whole congregation was standing and clapping with the choir. The Roman Catholic priest preached, and for the laying on of hands, there was the bishop, my mentor, a gay pastor who was still in the closet, a woman, the black pastor, and the priest, as they were framed in the bouquets of anthuriums from Hawaii. Oh, call number one, Ascension Lutheran Church, small congregation, 35 worshipers, planted in the 60s in the Air Force community. I was to be half-time to do supervising for the other half. However, my Zion Lutheran Church gave the other half of my salary to be a full-time pastor. The project was for me to be a confidential person for the Air Force women at Griffiths Air Force Base to come and have a confidant. And then others came too, Vietnam vets, a pondering Muslim, an abused mother. We grew to be over 100 members. We went into a building project where the interior was finished with the talents of a work crew from a local prison. We celebrated with a feast served on linen, china, crystal, sterling, all homemade foods that the men from the streets of New York had never experienced. We had a group named Accord. We worked with women released from mental institutions that had fallen through the cracks. An intelligent man from the base community, a leader in the church, looks at me one day and he says, "I pride myself in figuring people out, but I can't figure you out. However, it's working." My acceptance vote to come to this congregation was one name, and I learned when I left that it was Harvey, the founding father. He said, "I hated to see you come, I hate to see you go." In a Roman Catholic community, the cleric collar on a woman confused people. I've never seen one like you before. Do I call you Mother Marietta? I was the first woman to preach in a Roman Catholic pulpit with a tiny withered nun afterward taking my hand, looking up at me and saying, "We've come a long way, baby." The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Pastor Emeritus first didn't know what to call me, so I was the prophetess. Then at the second meeting, I was a priestess. And then after preaching at the LCMS chapel in the Adirondacks without the roof caving in, he named me pastor. I was invited to the 25th year celebration of my priest friend's ordination in Norfolk, Connecticut. He told me to bring my clerics. I led the procession of priests into the sanctuary. And the whispers went loudly ahead of me, "There's a woman! There's a woman! There's a woman!" A commitment I made was to always have a spiritual director for support and guidance, and to do periodic retreats. I did the 30 days of silence with the Jesuits in Guelph, Canada, where I walked, talked, danced with Jesus, a very personal relationship, even to being able to forgive my uncle. Call number two, beautiful Savior Lutheran Church in wealthy Bluefield Hills. They came for me to be on a male-female pastor team. I'll just say that the thing that really happened there after 5 years, that two men came worshiping at Beautiful Savior after the church had sponsored a synod-wide day for sharing stories of how homosexuality affected people's lives. After a year, these men requested a transfer of membership from Truth Lutheran Church in Detroit. When it arrived, they were denied membership, that even the bishop could not budge. Agony and prayer went into my sermons about inclusivity, being careful not to polarize the congregation, for most people did not know the situation. The senior pastor would not talk to me. He wanted to take away my responsibilities, which I refused to give up, and I was silently told to leave. The loving farewell was crowded with people, and still most didn't know the deceit that had come my way. I received supported letters from all over the USA and was invited to the Lutheran Concerns National Gathering, where I was immersed in the stories of those rejected from being part of the gospel. Call number three, I came to my sisters in Olivet to grieve. I talked to your bishop of your synod and Central Crossroads. And because the country churches had been set aside, I made the decision to re-enter my roots, to walk in the cornfields and ride the combines, and I took a threefold parish in Illinois. And it was fun. It was fun. Because as long as the congregations did not have to give up their church, they would do anything. The youth went work camping, the women did mission work, started a food pantry, a clothing closet. It was just so creative and so much fun. And then pastors in their 80s came and said, Pastor, I need to talk to you. For the first time, they told their World War stories of opening a concentration camp, of shooting young Japanese, of seeing their buddies' blood on their bodies. We had confessions and anointings. They had finally let the Spirit blow them into the forgiving arms of Jesus and be accepted by a loving, merciful God. Okay. My health gave way, I retired, I came to St. Louis, and there and here I have been ever since. I have blessed my sermons that I kept in file and rarely went back to, put them in the recycle bin, and all my clerics have gone to Eden Seminary. So here I am, I've chattered away with parts of my story. I did a lot of leaping and jumping without knowing the landings, but they brought me closer to God, Jesus, and the Spirit, which I cannot yet adequately explain, but know they have directed and still directed my life. Thank you.
After all of this.
I was born in 1936. 1936, I'm 81.
We need another week for questions.
You can ask me individually or if you have any comments, but I only knew that I was going to be a mother and live on a farm. And I trusted. And I took, some people would say risks, but I believe they were well-founded. And I can say basically I've had no fear. I've had more fear living in my own community than I did floating around the world.
Marietta, thank you so much. I heard, I think it was Val said, we need another week for questions. We need another week to hear what have you done since you retired? Because I know you've continued to be a prophetess, a priestess, and a pastor. Thank you so much. By the way, we do have one opening sometime in May, so maybe we'll bring it back for part two. Just quickly, I hope you're aware of what's coming up the next two Sundays. In South County, there is now about a two-year-old mosque. The director is a 32-year-old imam named Eldon Susha, and he is going to be with us for 2 weeks talking about the basics of Islamic faith and practice. So the next 2 weeks here. Please invite others to come. I think he will be a marvelous presenter. I've met with him personally. He's a wonderful young man, very, very open and excited to be here. I started our personal conversation by saying, let me tell you something about Bethel. He said, you don't have to. And I said, oh, really? He said, the fact that you're inviting me says a lot about who you are. So I think we're in for a road trip. He's spoken to a lot of Christian groups before, so he's experienced in this, and I think he has some sense of maybe what we'll ask him and discuss with him. So the next 2 weeks.
I should put in a plug, just think about it. Stephen Mager is going to be the first of our Reforming Reformation series in October. And he says he would like to respond to questions. Like the question is, what role does music play in an ever-evolving and reforming church? So any questions that you have about music and Reformation, he's going to punt. He didn't want to come with a presentation, but rather will speak from his decades of thinking through church music.
Good. That will be on October the 8th.
Yeah. And write your questions and send them to me, or bring them next week, or just anything. In fact, he likes the grittiest of questions.
Just a quickie about the October series. It will be on Reformation, renewing the church. And Stephen will be up October 8th. The 15th, Pastor and
Michael
Hoy will be with us. And I forget exactly
23rd
what...
23rd is...
23rd is Rebecca Boardman, and the final is a guest from Eden Seminary, Dr. Adam Floyd, who is going to talk to us about other reformations.